This week's episode of This Week on Broadway is sponsored by SeatGeek. That's SeatGeek. To get a $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Coming up on Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway, we catch up with a lot of reviews, 11 of them in fact. We're going to review 1776 at Encores, Southern Comfort at the Public, She Loves Me, Hold On to Me Darling, The Crucible, Blackbird, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, Cagney, Death for Five Voices, Bright Star, and The Effect. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 3rd, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Jan Simpson. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Jan Simpson, returning after a two-year absence. Good to have you back, Jan.
Good to be back.
Jan is the co-director of the Arts and Cultural Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and also writes for TDF Stages and Playbill. Thank you for joining us again, Jan.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So, Peter, 1776 is one of your favorite shows, so let's start there.
Yes, indeed it is. I think it has the best book in Broadway history, and yes, I've seen Gypsy. But the thing about Gypsy was, if you look at Gypsy Rose Lee's memoir, she actually has Act 1, Act 2, and Act 1 ends with Rose being dumped by June. So, I mean, it was pretty much there. Poor Peter Stone had to go back and look at congressional records and devise a plot that was really impossible when you think of it, because we all know how it turns out. We know on July 4th that, indeed, the Declaration will be signed. However, it has to be unanimous, and on June 29th, it's still 6-4-6 against and one abstention. So, I mean, how is it going to happen? Because that Dickinson guy is just not going to give in. That's all there is to it. It seems like a real miracle. So that's really terrific. While there are a number of strange, not to say false rhymes in the score, Sherman Edwards' music fits the bill quite nicely. So it's a terrific show, and I'm very sorry it didn't win the Pulitzer Prize back when it was first produced, because I think it deserved it. The Great White Hope won. Not a bad play, I'm not saying that, but still I would have given it to 1776, because it says so much about America, and it makes us so proud to be Americans, and we really appreciate what's going on in making this country happen. So, all right, now this is a different production from any we've ever seen before, because indeed it's using non-traditional casting. And we can really feel the effects of Hamilton's influence here. It's almost as if you couldn't get into Hamilton, why not come to 1776? And in fact, it was a hot ticket, a very hot ticket indeed. It's not a show that really lends itself to non-traditional casting, because it deals with the issues of slavery to begin with. However, the show is so indestructible that I have to say that after a while I even forgot that there was non-traditional casting involved. I was just so swept up in the action. This is even true with the fact that, good Lord, I mean, they even did it in modern dress, and I didn't really care. Would have I preferred traditional costumes? Yes, indeed, I would have. But still, the show came through loud and clear and wonderfully. And what I really liked so much was the fact that Santino Fontana playing John Adams, John Larroquette playing Franklin, and Bryce Pinkham playing Dickinson, you could tell that they hadn't seen the movie, or at least they hadn't been influenced by it, because I don't think there was a single line reading that came from the movie. And I thought that was really terrific. They all made it their own. I thought they were all very good. And again, it was a pleasure to see this magnificent show back, even for a little while.
All right, Jan, you also told me this is your favorite show, so why don't you go next?
It is. I'm delighted to hear that it's one of Peter's favorites, too. I'm not even sure why I so love this musical, because there's not a lot of music in it. But I guess because it really does tap into something about your patriotism, it really does stir you up at the end. I was a little suspicious, a little weary, I guess, going in about the non-traditional casting here. And I thought, I don't want to see a faux Hamilton. But what I think they did very smartly is that it was truly colorblind casting. And so the race of the actors had nothing to do with their parts. It wasn't making any statement. And what it did, I think, is by not trying to make a statement, it made a big one, that you can just cast the actors you want. And if they're good, and if the show is good, the audience is going to go with it. And so I thought that was really terrific. I'm in love with Santino Fontana. I think there's almost like nothing he can't do. I thought he was a wonderful John Adams. I just thought it was a terrific production.
All right, Michael, is this your favorite show?
It's definitely one. It's right at the top. And I was sitting next to David Spencer right before the show started. He said, "Oh, this is my favorite show." And I said, "Yeah, well," I said, "Yeah, it's really up there for me also." I think what happened in my case is that I don't know about the rest of you, but I somehow had heard about the non-traditional casting before I heard that it was going to be Modern Dress. And to be honest, when I heard about the non-traditional casting, not having heard about the Modern Dress, I thought that does not sound like a very good idea at all. And then when I heard about the Modern Dress right before seeing the show, that kind of flipped my whole perception of it, because I just thought it removed it enough from reality. Enough further from reality to make a big difference. That said, I don't know. I mean, having Richard Henry Lee be an African American, I'm not. You know, I guess we just kind of have to not really think about the further implications of that. But since it was so obviously not realistic in general, it reminds me of Modern Dress productions of Shakespeare. I always thought – I once did a production of King Lear that they sort of updated, but not really. But it was – people were in business suits at the beginning, and I thought, well, you know, this really does – there are moments when this really works. This could be like King Lear, dividing his estate, among – and there are so many things in all of these things that make them universal. But then, of course, you're eventually going to get to something that is completely wrong with modern day. And then whenever you do that, I guess you're just supposed to overlook it. I think one could argue that it's not necessary to have Modern Dress in order to underline the relevance of these things. Mm-hmm. And actually it's more effective if you see someone in 18th century costume and you see them complaining about how Congress doesn't do anything and how New York is so disorganized and blah, 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 blah. But whatever. It was so much to enjoy. So much of the casting was so spot on. The orchestra, the recreated original orchestrations were magnificent. Apparently William Daniels was at the talk back yesterday. I wish I had been there. I guess, Peter, maybe it's not true. I completely agree with you about people not doing line readings that we've heard before. But I kind of suspect maybe Santino Fontana has seen the movie, because apparently he bowed to William Daniels when he came.
I did hear that too. And that would indicate that he saw the movie, because I imagine he's much too young to have seen it on Broadway.
I would think so too. By the way, I went backstage to see Bryce Pinkham afterwards and to thank
him nice.
On the podcast, and I said, your number really brought down the house, which it did at my performance on Friday night. I don't know about you guys, cool, considerate men, just
absolutely
stop the show. And Bryce, with typical humor, said, "Yeah, it's funny to see a song like that get such a big hand when it's sung by a bunch of dicks." Yeah. And I said, "Yes," I said, "but that final chord." And he goes, "Oh yeah, it's like the a wall of man sound." Mm-hmm. Is how he put it. And the show does have, even though it's comparatively little music, it what's there is just fantastic. And
Alexander Gimignani stopped the show.
It's so funny you say that, because I was very sad that I didn't make that point. So you make it. Go ahead.
He has such a marvelous voice. So there was that. But just his performance of the rum and
molasses to rum,
right?
Molasses
to rum song just really did. I went to Saturday's matinee, and it really did. The audience just loved it. Just
it was the best one I've ever heard.
It was great. Yeah.
I've seen, I think, 16 productions of 1776, and it's the best I've ever heard, because he's somewhat, and I don't, this sounds like a left-handed compliment, I don't mean it at all, he somewhat spoke sang it. There was a lot of singing, believe me, mm-hmm. but there was a touch of speaking in it, and I've never heard the lyrics so clearly as I have in this rendition, and that's really important to hear the lyrics in this song. So, yes, my hat's off to him, too.
And his voice is very, very focused and very intense, I think. And he was fantastic. By the way, did you notice, Peter, I guess this is just a mistake and carried forward into the New York Times review. They list the title of the first song as "For God's Sake, John, Sit Down."
I know, yeah.
That's not right, is it?
No, Sit Down, John has always been the title.
Well, I mean, that's kind of unfortunate, especially because Bradley complained about it in the Times Review. I don't know if you saw that.
But that's the way they listed in the playbill.
No, that's what I'm saying. It was their error, but then carried forward. So that's too bad.
Yeah.
But a minor thing. I will see this show under any circumstances, and this, there were so many really, really great things in it that I thought absolutely phenomenal, Robert Sella. As the secretary.
I agree.
And also Andre DeShields. Mm-hmm. But I could go on and on. I mean, there were so many great people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have 10 shows to review, so we can't go on and on today. But quickly, in 15 seconds each, to wrap this up in a minute, do we think, since all of you, you list this as your favorite show, why hasn't it done better at the box office, and could this transfer?
It's done phenomenally well at the box office. I heard that this was one of the biggest Encore sellers.
Yeah, couldn't get a ticket.
Yeah, so...
James, you're being sarcastic.
Yes. Sorry.
I will say that I was sitting next to a producer who said he would be very interested in moving it as is. So who knows, we might see it if he can make it happen. But he came out of there so enthusiastically that was his first statement to me. So I won't say who, just in case, but nevertheless, that was something that was said immediately following.
It'd be great to have it during the election season.
Aha, yes, indeed. Good for you. Great.
Good thing is that there's always an election season, seemingly.
Nothing like this one. Anyway, go on.
Well, sometimes when you have an election season like this, you just have to turn to Southern Comfort. Jan, you got to see Southern Comfort, and so did Peter down at the Publix. So why don't you start us off with Southern Comfort?
Southern Comfort is a musical about a group of transgender people, primarily, who live in rural Georgia. They have created kind of a makeshift family to create a little oasis, a space where they can truly be themselves in a world that's not approving. It's based on a documentary of the same title called Southern Comfort that looked at this real community of people. Southern Comfort, the title, is taken from the name of an annual event that happens every year. I think for a long time took place in Georgia and now has moved to Florida, where transgender people and other people who are supportive of that community get together and party and trade information. In this play, though, in this musical, which was 10 years in the making, and I think that's a little bit of the reason that some people have not been as warm towards it, because it seems a little bit old-fashioned given the changes in or the changing attitudes towards transgender people. But in this show, it centers around this particular man named Robert Ead. And he was originally born a woman and has changed into the true identity that he self-identifies with, but he did not have all of the surgery, or perhaps any of the surgery, because ironically, he has been diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And the show takes place over the last few months of his life as he finds a lady love, a woman who is making the transition from male to female. And as he clashes with the young man who he has sort of adopted as a son, who, perhaps frightened by what has happened with Robert, is considering having this very difficult and very dangerous surgery, reassignment surgery. I found it to be a very moving show. I thought the performances were really incredible, particularly Annette O'Toole as Robert Ead. It took a while for me to figure out that it was she who was portraying the person, and even that it was a woman portraying the person. I thought she was just really terrific in the role. And Jeff McCarthy as this new, as this woman who is just beginning to try out her identity, who actually for most of the week lives and functions as a man in the real world because she's still very nervous about who she is, has the best number in the show and delivers it wonderfully. I was just very moved by it.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Yeah, I have to agree. And what I thought was really good is that so many dramatic situations came up that we don't necessarily think about in the transgender community. All right, I do think we think about the fact what happens when Robert goes home and his parents will not stop calling him Barbara. And they have complete hatred for the fact that he has made this transition. But the one that I really thought was poignant and something that had never occurred to me was when a woman gave her man a tie, and the man said, gee, it has Christmas decorations on it. It's not near Christmas time. And she said, no, well, you're going to the Christmas party with me. I want to show you off. And that's really something, the idea of do we think of that very much, that what's it like to bring a transgender person to a party? That's a big step. I mean, a lot of people are going to be unnerved by it or are going to be mocking of it or what have you. But this is a case where I don't care anymore. This is who we are. We are a couple, and that's all that's important. So I thought that was very effective. The scenes really, really were astonishingly good. And in terms of Annette O'Toole, I spent so much of the time looking to find Annette O'Toole in that human being that was on stage. I saw no trace of Annette O'Toole whatsoever. And I was very glad this week to see in the nominations of the Lucille Otell Awards that there she was represented, because this is an amazing performance. Mm-hmm. There are very few performances I've ever seen where a person completely loses himself or herself in the role to the point of which you cannot find the actor. So
At all.
Yeah. And everybody else was very good too. Jeff McCarthy was really very good in being shy and nervous and all that. And, you know, and understandably so, if you know what Jeff McCarthy looks like, this is not a person who is going to pass at all. As a woman, you know that this is somebody who was once a man or is still a man and going through the transition. So done very intelligently, very intelligently. And what was nice too, when I talked about, Annette O'Toole's character going home, Robert going home, is the fact that members of the band were asked to play roles, right, and they played the parents, and they were very effective, you know, because, you know, I don't know, these may be actors first and foremost and musicians second. I don't know what the situation is, but if indeed they are musicians first and actors second, they certainly gave first-rate performances in that very difficult situation for parents to be in. So I thought it was a terrific achievement. It moved extraordinarily well. I enjoyed the bluegrass music immeasurably, and I hope there's a future for this show.
Well, I think we do have to say, though, that some members of the transgender community criticized the fact that the show wasn't cast entirely with trans people. Two of the actors are transgender people, and the public has really responded. It has had meetings and with that community and has debated and discussed this openly. But seeing those two performances, particularly Annette O'Toole's performance, certainly there may be transgender actors who could do just as, you know, do it just as strongly and terrifically, but it's hard to criticize the fact that they went with such strong actors in the roles.
Well, this is not quite the same thing, but I will say this. There's a documentary about homosexuality that Harvey Fierstein appears, and he talks about the role of the sissy in movies back in the 20s and 30s, and how sissies were always mocked and they came across as silly, and that, and it really reinforced the stereotype that these people were just people to be laughed at. And he says, no, I like the sissy because it certainly represented that I existed. Similarly, David Henry Wang with the Flower Drum Song movie says, I have a million issues with Flower Drum Song, but I was so glad to see Asian people represented. So while indeed certainly the transgender community has a point here, I hope that they look at the glasses more than half full. That they certainly have, I mean, because there could have been, as we well know, a musical that laughed at transgenders and made them laughing stocks, people to be mocked at. And so given that there was so much sensitivity and intelligence here, I think that they should look at this glass as more than half full.
This week's episode of This Week on Broadway has been sponsored by SeatGeek. That's SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the hassle out of shopping for tickets. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on other sites into one place so you have time to pick the right tickets for yourself. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based upon value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. And best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticketing sites, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Don't we hate those checkout fees? Like pickup fee and printing fee and all the other fees. It makes me mad whenever I buy a ticket. Broadway Radio listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get this $20 rebate, do this. Download the free SeatGeek app on your iPhone, your Android device, your iPad, various different devices. Go to the settings tab and add a promo code. Enter the promo code BR 20. That's B as in Broadway, R as in radio, and the number 20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter the code BR20 today. Thank you so much to SeatGeek for sponsoring Broadway Radio. And if you love Broadway Radio, really, download their app and check it out to support the sponsors who support Broadway Radio. Thanks so much. Michael and I got a chance to see She Loves Me. I Love You, She Loves Me. And Michael, how did you feel about it?
Well, I wanted to respond to what Peter said when he talked about it a couple of weeks ago about how there was, he basically loved the show, but there was nothing Hungarian about it. Yeah. And I completely agree. But I also wanted to say to maybe amplify and specify more and say that to me, there was nothing period about it. Mm-hmm. In terms of the performance, the sets and the costumes, yes, but other things, the hairstyles on both Laura Benanti and Jane Krakowski, I don't think those have anything to do with what those women would have been wearing at that time. And also everyone's body language, everyone's face, a lot of facial expressions struck me as just very, very, very modern. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but I guess it's not my preference. I guess I prefer a more of a period sense in the performance. Now, who knows? When the show was new in the early 60s, maybe the performances of Barbara Cook and Daniel Massey and everyone else struck everyone as very modern at that time. I can't really say. But that is something I noticed. I also noticed I love the full orchestra. I love them having them in the boxes. I thought the tempos were very, very fast.
Yeah.
Sometimes too fast. That said, the show was still like 2 hours and 50 minutes long. So that's 2:50. So I guess they were keeping that in mind. Maybe some judicious cuts would have been good. We did not have the Tango Tragique number, which I think is just fine to cut that. I don't think that really is what we need at that point in the show. But I really, really enjoyed it very much, with the caveat that the whole style of it was a little too modern to me, and also a little too show busy. The best production of She Loves Me I ever saw, and I would say the only one that got the tone really right for me, was a production, Peter, I forget if you saw this, in 1989 at something that was called the Opera Ensemble of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Tunick's group. He founded it, and he would conduct full orchestras in these productions of shows in a place called the Lily Blake School Theater at 45 East 81st Street.
Wow.
And they did She Loves Me with Greg Edelman as George. Mm-hmm. And Davis Gaines as Kodai. A woman named Elizabeth Walsh was Amalia, and I don't.
Oh, I know Elizabeth Walsh.
Do you know her?
New York City Opera, Elizabeth Walsh.
I believe so, and she did. Yeah. She did a couple of other shows for them too.
I did Showboat with her, and she was Magnolia.
Oh yeah, well she was great, and the other, I think a lot of the other people you wouldn't have heard of, but it was really wonderful. I kind of wish I could. Don't you wish that we could relive all of these things? I don't know.
I'll say.
Funny you should say that, Michael, because through Broadway HD, we can now relive. They are not a sponsor. They are not.
But anyway, bottom line, I'm sure that that everyone will enjoy. Well, I think this is a very, very good production of She Loves Me, with the caveats that I mentioned, and certainly anyone who loves the show should see it, and anyone who has never seen the show should absolutely see it, and we'll get a very, very good idea of what all the fuss is about.
My wife Laura and I really enjoyed the show. We had a great time at it, and when she left, it's funny you should mention that, Michael, about everything. She's like, why were all their names so strange? And I was like, well, it was because it was not set here. And she was like, oh, it was like She Loves Me meets the Housewives of Northern New Jersey. Uh-huh. You know? Zachary Levi was great. I love him in this role, as I loved him in First Date. Was it First Date? Was that his thing?
That's right.
What a cast. Laura Benanti was incredible. Gavin Creel, Byron Jennings, Michael McGrath, Jane Krakowski, just really wonderful. I wanted to point out this, that the costume and set design I thought was so beautiful and integrated together, and the colors that every time Laura Benanti was on stage, she had that pinkish rose color that lit up the set no matter what she was wearing. She's just stunning. Thing about She Loves Me for me was that act one is a lot of setup, and act two is knock them all down. And I thought it was great, and I really encourage everybody to get out to see this thing. It was really beautiful and very enjoyable. It's one of my favorite shows. So next up, Jan and Michael got to see Hold On To Me, Darling. So, Michael, start us off with that.
Hold On To Me, Darling is too much of a okay thing, I thought. It was very, very, very long, very, very overwritten. Did not see it, but I seem to remember that this was an issue in, was it his last play, Kenneth Lonergan's last play, The Starry Messenger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
To the point right. where it got into the press because it became an issue yeah. with Matthew Broderick not being able to handle all of the, mm-hmm. The rewrites and all of the sheer amount of the line. This one is about a country singer named Strings McCrane, played by Timothy Oliphant, who basically decides he wants to give up his career and go, you know, live the simple life back home. And I thought there were many good things in it, including several of the performances. Keith Nobbs, one of my favorite actors, C.J. Wilson, Jonathan Hogan, and a few other people. I thought actually that Timothy seemed very disconnected from the text at many points. But there were so many things that happened that seemed like completely, so completely unbelievable that I kept being taken out of the story. We're supposed to believe that this fellow quits a movie he has already started filming and quits an incredibly lucrative concert tour just because he has to immediately go back and start living the simple life rather than waiting a couple of months and doing it then. And then he doesn't seem to realize that people are going to sue him for backing out of these things for millions and millions of dollars. And then he decides after some unspecified amount of time, oh, you know, well, maybe I'll go back to the movie and the concert tour and, you know, so that they won't sue me. I don't think they would have waited 2 months for you to decide that you're going to go back. So the whole thing seemed, there was a lot of tremendous bullshit in it, and I'm not sure what Kenneth Lonergan was thinking of. I think the basic idea was very good, and there were a lot of very, very funny lines in it, but I thought it was overwritten and confused, and I hate to say it, maybe this is another case where a playwright becomes so well known and successful that he or she no longer feels it necessary to edit him or herself. And other people are loath to say, Kenny, you know, some of this has got to go and some of this has got to be worked on. So I wish that he had done that because I think there is something good in there. It just was very overwritten and kind of confused.
All right, Jan, what did you think?
I agree with Michael. It's but I have to say I had a good time. It's overly long. It's silly. It's improbable. there's one sort of section where someone gets divorced, married, and starts another divorce, and it's all within like 2 or 3 weeks. It just doesn't all fit together. But he is trying to say something about celebrity culture and mm-hmm. the way that celebrities themselves, that a person who did come from a simple life, this is a guy from a small Tennessee town, he becomes a mega star. And when he says he wants to go back to the simple life, he has no idea of what the simple life is anymore. He wants the simple life as lived by a major celebrity. Mm-hmm. And then there are all the people around him who in one way or another find that lure of celebrity just irresistible. Mm-hmm. They want to pretend they're closer to him than they are. They say they don't care about fame, and yet, you know, it's not so bad when paparazzi are taking your photos. It's an interesting idea, and I agree with Michael, and I think that we have to bring in the director, Neil Pepe, here, because he's been around a long time. I think he's known Lonergan a long time. And he really should have said what Michael, you know, just said. You know, hey, Kenny, we gotta work on this more. Because the idea is very good. And I thought the performances were really good. And I don't know, maybe I'm just susceptible to Timothy Olyphant, who I thought looked really great.
Me too.
So I was okay with a little bit of lapses here and there. It was fine. And the other people, the supporting people, C.J. Wilson was very funny. Keith Nobbs was hysterical. So a lot of really good elements, including the basic idea of the show, and it just needed to be trimmed and punched into shape a little more.
All right. So that's Hold On To Me, Darling. Next up, we have Peter got a chance to see The Crucible, and the rest of us are going to see it later on this week and next week. So, Peter, give us a preview of what we're going to be in for.
All right, friends. I dare say that you should read the play again or watch the movie if you're not really, really, really familiar with The Crucible, and I suspect you are. But for anybody out there who doesn't know The Crucible, please, I beg of you, watch the movie or read the play, because you're not going to have any idea what's going on up there. And I like Ivo van Hove very much, usually, but this time he's just gone too far as I'm concerned. And it's hard to find the play on that stage. One of the reasons it's hard to find the play, I never realized that the Walter Crowe Theater has such a wide stage. It's certainly too wide for what he's doing. Hmm. It's set in a classroom. I have no idea why. Girls are wearing school uniforms, I guess, to indicate how young and innocent they are. And it does make a point when all these adults are, you know, swarming around these kids in schoolgirl uniforms. It does make them seem like tremendous bullies. So that, I guess, is kind of effective. You know, I was wondering, here's a suggestion that may be just as bad as what I'm seeing on stage. But if you're going to do something with the Crucible in a different setting, instead of a schoolroom, why not set it in a Senate chamber hearing? Because this was a metaphor back then for what was going with the Joseph McCarthy hearings, the House Un-American Activities. People reluctant to name names, people naming names so they wouldn't lose their careers, all that kind of stuff. If it was set there, I think that would really be interesting, because that was Miller's point all along. I have to say, too, that Ben Whishaw was very bland in the part, much too much so. Sophie Okonedo, I thought, was quite good as John Proctor's wife. She does have quite the British accent, but, you know, these people aren't that far removed from the Mayflower, so I guess this character would either be from England or was influenced by her parents and spoke that way, so that was fine with me, too. Abigail Williams, played by that movie star whose name I can't remember. Can you help me here, friends?
Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I thought she was really good, and had a very distinctive voice that I really enjoyed listening to, so I liked her. But good Lord, where is the play in all this? I mean, I just couldn't find it at all, and I certainly would have been thoroughly confused, if I didn't know the play.
Well, as others have pointed out, and you basically just said, The Crucible, Arthur Miller's The Crucible as it is already a metaphor.
Yeah.
So if you pile another one onto it, and then not only that, but one that doesn't really make a lot of sense, it sounds to me like it would be a problem. I understand that the reviews for this have been almost completely positive, mm-hmm. and very much so. So who knows? Yeah. I will see soon.
All right. So all of us will see it, minus Peter. Peter has already seen it, obviously. So we'll come back and let you know what we think about it. But Peter, Michael, and I got a chance to see Blackbird over at the Belasco Theater. And so, Michael, why don't you start us off with Blackbird?
Well, I had seen the show off Broadway. How long ago was it?
Yeah, something close to 10 years. Really?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Isn't it? Yeah, face it. Yeah.
It was certainly before Jeff Daniels' recent big, huge TV resurgence success. So that's something that's happened during that time, and maybe that was largely responsible for the show coming to Broadway. I don't know why, but I liked it so much better off Broadway. I think a lot of it has to do with Michelle Williams' performance. There is certainly justification from an intellectual standpoint to make this woman so obviously, I want to say, disturbed. But can either how many of you saw it off Broadway?
I did.
Yeah, I saw it.
Do either of you? I wish my memory were better, and especially in cases like this. Did she have a stutter?
I don't remember Alison Pill having a stutter.
Yeah, I don't remember Alison Pill having a stutter either. And again, it's perfectly justifiable from an intellectual standpoint. But I just thought it there was so much of it, and she was so stuttery and so twitchy. I'm talking about Michelle Williams, that it kept taking me out of the text. It had the opposite effect that it was supposed to, and I really think that was a tremendous miscalculation on her or the director's part. The director being Joe Mantello. So that alone really. Really was a detriment to me. I thought Jeff Daniels was great as he was the first time, and I think it's a really, really interesting story about this young woman who years later shows up at the place of employment of an older man who had with whom she had had a sexual relationship when she was underage, and how she confronts him and all the incredible amount of baggage and hurt that goes along with that. The question is, what does she want from him now? What if anything does she exactly want? Why is she confronting him? What does she want him to say or do? I think that's all really, really interesting as written by David Harrower. And I loved the play off Broadway, but I liked it much less here. And I think that performance is the main reason why.
It played off Broadway in 2007, just about 9 years ago. And the interesting part with Jeff Daniels was in that same role, and Alison Pill joined him on his HBO show that just wrapped up a few years ago after Blackbird.
Newsroom. So,
Newsroom. Mm-hmm. So, Peter, what did you think?
I agree with what's been said, so I'm going to say something completely different. This is going to seem to be a very odd perception, but, you know, when we're taking driver's ed, we're always shown these movies where kids are driving too fast and they get into terrible accidents and their lives are changed forever and all that kind of business. In a strange way, I think this play really should be shown to people who are considering having affairs with underage people, because indeed, there's no question that it's a very easy thing to do with young girls who want to seem older than they are. Mm-hmm. And that point is made too, that indeed she wanted to seem more sophisticated. And what could be more sophisticated than having a grown man interested in you when you're a little child? And this is a tough situation, because no matter what happens, how much the little girl wants it, it's still the adult responsibility to say, no, this is not going to happen. Go find a boy your own age. I think this is worthwhile to really think about. That's my perception there. I don't know how you round up potential pedophiles to have them see you. I'll grant you that. But, and I know it sounds like I'm being very flip here, and I'm not. I'm very serious about this. But I do wish this play were seen by people who were thinking of doing this, because I dare say they would not think of it, or at least they would suppress the feelings after they saw it. I'm very effective to me. And yes, I agree, Michelle Williams isn't as good as Alison Pill. But I think if you haven't seen Alison, you'd be all right with this production.
Also, I should say, having said all of that negative about Michelle Williams, for in both her case and Jeff Daniels, it's absolutely amazing when those of us who don't do this, when you think of those two people doing such intense drama eight mm-hmm. times a week, mm-hmm. I mean, that alone is worth some kind of award, mm-hmm. you know, regardless of whatever I may feel about her, you know, her choices and her misinterpretation. It's the achievement is incredible. And as often as we've seen it, it still astounds me, especially when it's something so dramatically intense and so draining. They really deserve credit, incredible credit for that.
So I think that, Michael, what you're pointing out is, I think, one of the reasons why this show is here right now, right before the award seasons, with 87 and a half producers for a two-person show. I hadn't seen Alison Pill. I had not seen the show before. And I was incredibly uncomfortable during the whole show. And I was pushing back, and I was wondering, was it that I wasn't happy with Michelle Williams' choices, or is it just that this whole topic is really hard to watch? Mm-hmm. But I'm really interested now. I wonder if Lincoln Center's got a video of the show 10 years ago or 9 years ago. So I'm interested to see it, but I think that this is going to be an often mentioned name in the upcoming awards season.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen this production, but I, like Michael, I love the 2007 production. But as you guys have been talking, and particularly Peter's comments, I think about it in comparison to How I Learned to Drive, Paula Bowles' story. And I find it very interesting the way that men and women come at this same topic of young girl, older man. And, well, just that. I think there's a difference. I think both plays are really compelling and give you a lot to think about. But I think there's a real different sensibility and approach, and maybe even sympathy coming from male and female points of view.
You're talking about the playwrights. The fact mm-hmm. that the playwright is mm-hmm. male mm-hmm. for one and female mm-hmm. for the other. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And Peter, I don't think your remark was flip at all. I knew exactly what you meant.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think, yes, I think it would be great if, you know, unlikely as it is, if
unlikely as it is, yeah,
people who are considering doing that could see a play like this.
Mm. All right, let's move forward. Jan and Peter got a chance to see White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, which I'll let them explain the concept. But Jan saw Nathan Lane and Peter saw Whoopi Goldberg. So, Jan, why don't you start us off with Nathan?
Lucky me. Okay, this is a production that's being done once a week on Monday nights. It is a one-person show. The conceit is that a well-known star comes on stage, and he or she is supposedly given a script that they've never seen before. And they read the script. And the script is written by, I believe, an Iranian, or maybe a Syrian playwright, a Middle Eastern playwright, and someone who lived in this country. And he's writing about his experience of being an artistic person in a country that practices censorship. And there's a lot of audience participation, and it's expected that the star is going to improvise and interact with the audience. And ostensibly, we're not supposed to know what's real and what isn't. So the actor has been given a vial, and the vial is supposed to have poison in it. And there are then it's sort of like three card Monty. There are other vials and so on stage. And the audience sort of selects which one the actor is supposed to drink. And then the actor drinks from the potion, the vial, and lies down on a couch. And the audience is not supposed to know if it has killed the actor or not, because that's the end of the play. I have ruined this play. I have spoiled it. You walk out and you don't know if the actor is dead or alive. However, I think that had Nathan Lane, had my audience killed him, we would know. So, you know, with Nathan Lane, you're getting Nathan Lane. So there were funny moments. Nathan Lane, I don't know if he can give a bad performance. He was funny. There were a couple of moments where he's supposed to be serious, moving, thoughtful, just a couple of them. And I thought he was. Our audience was really game to be in it. These productions are raising money, and I think this is really important to know. They're raising money for PEN, the International Writers Organization that supports writers around the world who are subject to censorship. So the play has a mission. It's a bit confusing. I think it will depend on who you see. And they've lined up some really big names to see.
All right. So, Peter, what did you think?
Well, let's not forget that vile is a homonym, and we do have the word V-I-L-E. And I found this a vile theatrical experience. I hated it like poison. It's one of the worst experiences I've ever had in 55 years of going to the theater continuously. I don't know how the other 237 people felt. Now, why do I know there were 237 people in the house? Because in a 75-minute play, 5 to 10 minutes are taken where we count off how many people are in the house. So they go to extreme stage left, and the guy says one, the next person says two. I think I was 128. Anyway, so that kills a few minutes. Well, Whoopi Goldberg, it was amazing. You know, at one point, she actually looked at us and in thorough confusion and said, is this a little different from what you expected to see? I'm as shocked as you are. See, here's the thing. It's a serious play. You come in there. There's Nathan Lane. There's Whoopi Goldberg. These are people we associate with funny things. You know, after all, Nathan's been in a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. You know what I mean? I know he takes issue with this. I've written about this. He has written me about it, you know, that he feels, no, I am a serious actor too. And I'm not saying he's not, but what I'm saying is the bulk of the roles he's been cast in, the majority, have been funny parts. And people come in expecting they're going to have a laugh riot with people like Nathan Lane and Whoopi Goldberg. And to find out that so much of it has to do with suicide. Seriously, we get statistics that there are 18 ways that people traditionally commit suicide, that 95% of first-time suicide attempts fail, but 37% of failures succeed the second time around. I mean, is this something you expect to hear from Whoopi Goldberg or Nathan Lane? I mean, it's so bizarre. We always hear that some performers are so great that they could read the phone book. I bet that Whoopi Goldberg, the night I was there, wished that she had had her yellow pages there so she could have read that instead of this play. So it wasn't for me at all.
All right. So let's move forward then. Was Cagney for you? Peter got a chance to see Cagney. And what'd you think?
I thought Robert Creighton was awfully good. I think he's got the mannerisms. I think he's got the voice. I think he's a terrific performer. He carries the show on his shoulders. It's a wonderful showcase for him. Unfortunately, the show's a little boring because it doesn't have a point of view beyond telling us what happened in Cagney's life. So I'm afraid that it just plods on and everything that you expect to happen happens. The big drama is supposed to be that years later, Jimmy Cagney and Jack Warner, who was his boss for a long time and whom he rebelled against, meet at this ceremony where James Cagney is going to get a special award. And in fact, Jack Warner is going to present it to him. Yeah, okay, I can understand there'd be a little embarrassment or a little hard feelings there and all that. But I don't think it's enough to hang a show on, I'm sorry to say. And everybody in it's very good. Danette Holden's especially good playing a number. Everybody plays a number of roles. The actor who's playing Bob Hope, I have to say, does not remotely resemble Bob Hope. But all in all, it seems like a type of documentary at best. The music is okay. The lyrics are especially good. There's a lot of original music in the show. If you go in expecting just to hear Yankee Doodle Dandy, which you will, of course, hear, or Give My Regards to Broadway, which you, of course, will hear, there's a lot more to it than that. And it really is a genuine musical, beautifully produced at the West Side Theater, upstairs from that atrocity, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit. It really is something in terms of these producers putting on stage a quality production. There are a lot of slides. A lot of costumes. It must be madness backstage, changing from one to the next. So it's very ambitious in that way. It's ambitious in every way except in the writing of the script. Nothing unexpected really happens, and under those circumstances, it can be quite boring.
All right. Well, I guess.
Yeah, I saw it at the York Theatre Company when it was done last year. And I think the big problem is that James Cagney led a pretty ordinary life for a movie star. I mean, he was a terrific actor. He had a successful marriage. He wasn't a drunk. He didn't do drugs. There wasn't a lot of material to work with.
He didn't get the Charlie Sheen Award.
No. But Robert Creighton, this has been his passion project for a very long time because he so resembles Cagney. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it, he really threw himself into it, dancing, singing. He also worked on the score and the lyrics. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful vehicle for him. It's just, it's unfortunate that he didn't resemble Charlie Sheen. Instead, there would be a lot more to work with.
Well, we often wonder, was Cagney a bright star?
Ah.
So Michael and Peter got a chance to see the new musical Bright Star. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Oh, thanks. Well, the good news is I really like the music very, very much. And I don't normally like bluegrass, if that's the correct description for it. This is music, book, and story by Steve Martin, music, lyrics, and story by Edie Brickell. So let's see. If you figure that out, that means that the lyrics are the work of Edie Brickell alone. And actually, that to me was one of the two biggest downfalls of the show, or one of the three biggest downfalls. I thought that a lot of the lyrics were very, very poor in terms of lack of rhyme, which bothered me even more in this context than in some other contexts. I don't think it helped at all to have them not rhyme, and I think it just the non-rhymes were so off that I kept wondering what the next one was going to be, and I don't think that's a good thing. And the book. Also missed accents in the lyrics frequently. I really noticed a lot of those. And the book, I just thought it was so silly that, and I should say, speaking as someone who is usually the last person in the theater, to guess a twist ending, I guessed this one by, I'm not kidding you, I think the second scene of the first act. So that I guess kind of worked against my my enjoyment. I will say a fair percentage of the audience gasped at the moment of the reveal at the very end of the show. So I don't know. I'm surprised to say that, and I'm surprised that it happened. But that is a fact. I thought that overall it was very good in terms of construction aside from that, and I thought that the way that the songs were slotted was very intelligent. I thought there were some wonderful performances, most specifically Carmen Cusack, Paul Alexander Nolan, and A.J. Shively. And I just, yeah, I mean, I think if the way I understand it, it's a completely original story. And I think if they had just finessed it in terms of the ending, the twist, and also some of the plot elements, it would have been a much better show. But I also think this was directed by Walter Bobby, who is probably not the best person to choose to direct your new musical, because he has had far less success with new musicals than he has had with revivals.
Peter, what did you think?
I thought it was beautifully staged, though. I thought it moved very, very well.
Yes, yes.
Michael's 100% correct, though, about the
writing.
I shouldn't say that. You know, what I should say is I agree with Michael. You know, because who knows? Maybe we're both wrong. But nobody gasped at my performance, I'll tell you. You know, the fault is Steve Martin's, because he gives so much attention to a certain character. It's hard to talk about this without giving things away, so please bear with me. He gives so much attention to a certain character, that's when we figure out that this character must have a relationship with another character, because why would we be spending all this time with a character if indeed it wasn't going to turn out to be an important character? It would have been much smarter if there were just tangential moments, and it could have been solved very easily. I know I'm being terribly oblique, but anyway, let's put it this way, that there's a woman who's a very powerful editor at a magazine, and there's a young man who wants to be a writer and wants to break in, the newspaper actually, and wants to break in, and he keeps showing up, and she's not giving him the time of day. If it had been left at that, we would have been much more surprised at what happened later. Please forgive me if I've given something away. Please forgive me if you say, what are you talking about? I mean, it's always hard with these type of spoiler alerty type shows. So I blame Steve Martin for not understanding that, or not expecting that his audience was bright enough to be able to discern what the twist ending was going to be. So the other thing I want to say is, if I could be a fly on the wall, I would have liked to have been in the Paul Simon, Edie Brickell household when Edie said, I'm going to write a Broadway musical. And what did Paul Simon say to that, given that he had very little success some years ago with The Cape Man, which I thought was an ill-conceived project because he was dealing with a common criminal and it's not somebody we could really get behind or care about. But I wonder if he said to her, honey, you're out of your mind, or honey, go for it. It was a good experience for me. I got a Tony nomination. I mean, who knows? But I would like to know the answer to that question, if he encouraged her or discouraged her. Again, this is another one of those shows where you'd love to buy people a rhyming dictionary and teach them to use it. So so there is a problem there. But this is a show that I think could bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people, if Michael's saying that people gasped. So they're obviously very much into it. Michael, did they gasp as much as they gasped it straight?
Not as much. But at least not the people around me, but I was sitting with the critics, so maybe. I should say what I meant about Walter Bobby was in terms of dramaturgy, in terms of
fair.
Not being able to identify dramaturgical
issues.
I agree with you that the staging was very good, and it probably helped greatly by Josh Rhodes' choreography. But also, and we don't necessarily have to say a word more, but as far as spoilers, we zipped over a tremendous one in terms of in terms of the Jeff Daniels play Blackbird. It is kind of I kind of feel like that's happening more and more, that people are putting these spoiler things in their shows, and that kind of prevents reviewers from talking about it. and when the spoiler is something that we feel doesn't work, we're kind of hamstrung. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to point that out.
I haven't seen this one yet. It's coming up this week for me. But in looking at the cast, and Michael mentioned some of the cast before, it's got an amazing, outstanding cast. But most of the reviews and the discussion today has really focused on Steve Martin and Edie Brickell. We haven't made it there. So sometimes shows can't get out of their own way. So let's move forward into, we're rounding the bend into our 10th show of this morning. Our penultimate show, the second to last show, is Death for Fire Voices at the Sheen Center, where Peter got a chance to see it. Peter, give us 2 minutes on that.
Peter Mills is an astonishingly gifted writer, no question about that. And his score probably has the most beautiful music that can be possibly heard around town. This is the story of a genuine composer from way back when. I'm not going to give his name because I don't want to be a spoiler here either, because this is a true story. And in case people know this composer, I don't want to give away the background in that sense. But what I will say is that at the end of the show, some unexpected things happen. All right, I'm going to have to get into it. Fine. So he's a composer, and this is way back when, this is when the church has a profound influence on people, and there is an up-and-coming priest who ultimately becomes a cardinal who keeps on saying to him, you must write liturgical music. And he says, I'm not going to do that. I have no interest in that whatsoever. And that turns out to be very significant towards the end of the show. Again, I don't want to give it away, but it becomes so significant, and it really indicates corruption in the church, by the way. That's where it becomes fascinating, right at the end. Most of it has to do with the fact that he's involved in a marriage with a woman he's sort of likes, sort of doesn't. He's more interested in her as a muse than he is as a wife. He feels that she inspires him in that way, but not in any other way. So it doesn't take long before this woman decides to take a lover who's a very good friend of his. So that involves a great many complications. I'm not going to give the actor's name. This is the second time I've seen him this season. I think he's truly terrible. And I'm sorry to say that, because I know he's sincere in what he's doing, but very rarely have I seen an actor who shows you he's acting so much. And so I really think this is a tremendous liability with the production. I liked everybody else, by the way. So if you just sit there and enjoy the music, but it's very easy to tune out on the story, but boy, the last 5 minutes really pack a wall up, because it goes in a direction you never thought it was going to go, which is something we can't say for Bright Star, but we can say a Death for Five Voices.
Peter, I'm a little confused. I read the press release. I haven't seen the show. Don't we know the composer's name from the beginning or not?
We do, but I'm purposely keeping that quiet, because I know there are people who are very aware of this composer, and I do not want that them to know the story too much about him. So I'm leaving it at that.
Oh, but I just want to make sure I understand. When you go to the show and you open the program, it tells you.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
All right. So the last review of the morning. Michael, Peter, and Jan got to see The Effect. So Jan, why don't you start us off there?
The Effect is a show that's set in a medical facility where they're doing a testing of drugs that...
antidepressant.
Yes, thank you. I was going to say have to do with depression. Antidepressants. And two people have signed up for this month-long experiment where they're being monitored very closely to see what side effects the drug may have. During the course of their being there, they begin to become attracted to one another. And the question is this their genuine emotion, or is this a side effect of the drugs they're taking? At the same time, the two of the doctors who are supervising the experiment also have their own story and their own past relationship. This play is by Lucy Prebble, who people may remember a few years ago brought Enron here, which was, I think, won awards for best new play in London. This is like 3 years ago. And when it came to Broadway, lasted maybe less than a month or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I liked Enron, so for whatever that's worth. And I was interested to see this. This is a much smaller, much more intimate production. It's directed by David Cromer. So that immediately sort of, you know, increases your interest because he does very interesting things. I like the show quite a bit. I thought it raised some really interesting ideas about science, the emotions, love. And I thought the actor who played the guy in the test, I thought they were everybody was really good. But this guy, Carter Hudson, I had never seen him before. He's not a conventionally handsome leading man type, but to me, he just had such incredible charisma and was such a natural actor. I found it hard to take my eyes off him. I thought he was really sensational. So I really enjoyed the show.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
You know, I was just going to say, that's so interesting you said that. I thought that both Susanna Flood, who plays Connie Hall, and Carter Hudson, who plays Tristan Fry, they are the two undergoing the clinical trial. I had the same reaction about both of them. Neither one of them is like so beautiful that you would expect to see them on the cover of Vogue or anything like that. But they came across to me as two of the most attractive people I have ever seen because of their – they were just so charming and witty, and their chemistry was absolutely off the charts, which is – so vital to this play.
Exactly.
I can't even tell you. Without getting into it, the question is, the main question is, these two start to fall in love or think they're falling in love with each other. And the question is, are they really falling in love or is it just the effect of the antidepressants? And then things are complicated further because we eventually learn that one or both of them may be on a placebo. And so then it gets really, really interesting. I do agree with some criticisms that I've heard from some other people that the subplot is that the two doctors, Dr. Lorna James, played by Katie Brazda, and Dr. Toby Seeley, played by Steve Key, they are supposed to – they have a romantic history with each other as well. And I thought that maybe a little bit – too much time was spent on that relationship just because it was, to me, not as interesting. But I adored this play. I think it was so beautifully written by Lucy Prebble, and I urge everyone to see it. I just really – it was a very, very memorable, very moving experience to me. Something happens at the end, which I wouldn't say is a twist, but something happens that's somewhat unexpected. And at first I wasn't sure about it, but it was so moving that it actually brought me to tears. I urge everyone to see this play.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Yeah, I have nothing to add. I was going to add that I thought the nurse was awfully good, but Michael's already accomplished that as well. So really, I thirded the emotions here. So, by all means, get down to the effect.
All right. So we've made it through all 11 of the reviews this morning. I want to thank everybody for hanging in there. And before we get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, you can automatically download it to iTunes. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. One of the ways you can listen to us is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device. Get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me, and for Jan can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as the links back to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week's trivia?
Sure. And once again, Phil Bond was the first to get it and was very embarrassed that he's getting them so quickly. I think he should be very pleased by it. Jay Clark followed soon thereafter. The question was three musicals that played the St. James Theater, Hello, Dolly, The Producers, and Something Rotten. Yeah, they all had supporting actors win Tonys, but they had something else in common. And I noticed this when I went back to Something Rotten last week for the fifth time, and that there's a courtroom scene deep in the show, and there's a courtroom scene in The Producers deep in the show, and a courtroom scene in Dolly deep in the show. So that's the commonality among the three musicals that have played the St. James. As for this week, okay, in the 70s, on two separate occasions, 45 RPM singles were made of two show songs, one on each side of the record, songs taken directly from the 33 and a third RPM original cast album. I'm not talking about a cover. I'm talking literally from the original cast album. Songs were released as singles. Now, the 70s was the first decade when the recording industry was starting to distance itself from musicals. So it didn't want to say on each side of the 45 from the original cast album of. So both singles used the actual name of the shows and pretended that these names are actually the names of groups. All right, if you're finding this hard to follow, I'll give you an example. If the song had been Little Hands from Anya, the record would claim that the group singing it was actually named Anya. All to mask that it came from the now dreaded animal called the Broadway musical. So now I'm looking for the names of the four songs, two to a side, they were on two 45s, as well as the names of the so-called groups that were actually the names of the shows. All right, now here's a hint. One of the records was from a big hit, and the other was from a big flop. Okay, what are they?
All right, so if you know that answer, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So thanks for hanging in there, and on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, and Jan Simpson, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
The sun is going to shine again. 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 Something tells me it'll be all right. Something tells me it's going to be okay. Shine again.